Welcome to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Massini. We're returning to our reading of Glaciers, a novel by Alexis M. Smith. In our last episode, Isabel enjoyed a quiet morning moment with Spoke, her co-worker at the public library and a former soldier. She reminisced on a conversation she had with Spoke about his experiences in Iraq, and in a phone call to her friend Leo, she confesses the crush she's developed on Spoke and considers asking him to join her at a friend's party that night. With this thought in mind, Isabel heads out into the city of Portland on her lunch break. Here's Alexis M. Smith reading her novel, Glaciers.
Danish Modern. As she leaves the library, there are no human sounds, only machine sounds. The refrigerator humming, the susurration of the vents, their steady mechanical exhalations. Everyone has slipped out for lunch ahead of her. Outside at midday, Isabel feels the last breath of summer on her skin. The hum of the library is still in her ears, but drowning now in the noise of the city. She smells the food carts from blocks away, the hot oil and garlic and roasting meat that flows through the air every workday, mingling with the rank warm sewers and the burnt oil musk of the buses and delivery trucks. And under that, when her feet tread the grass under the trees, the smell of damp bark and vegetal decay. She breathes it in and lets herself think of Spoke. She imagines walking with him like this through the city, telling him how cold air and leaves and gasoline smell like the first day of school to her. It's a strange product of infatuation, she thinks, to want to tell someone about mundane things. The awareness of another person suddenly sharpens your senses so that the little things come into focus and the world seems more beautiful and complicated. When M wrote to L, she thinks, he didn't tell her about his journey. There was no description of the city or his lodgings or museums. The brevity of the postcard, the intense focus on the moment in the park, it was as intimate as a young man could be, like reaching out and brushing a strand of hair from her eyes. Isabel imagines M, and she can't help seeing him as a character in an Antonioni film, young, disaffected, wandering. He wears a wrinkled button-down shirt and a jacket, trim trousers, and of course the hat, a dashing straw fedora, brown with a dark band. She sees him clearly, though in this film of hers, everything is just barely in color, like the postcard. She thinks of everything she knows about 1965 and comes up with a meager tableau of the Vietnam War, Pucci prints, and Danish modern furniture. But M, she can see clearly. He could be the prototype of any young man in her city. The mustachioed barista, the tattooed bookseller, the plaid-shirted clerk at New Seasons Market. This is the way it would have been for Elle, too, Isabel thinks, never having been to Amsterdam. She would cobble together a picture with images from postcards and books and photographs. She would close her eyes and see him sitting under the trees, taking off his hat and resting it beside him, brim up. He reclines on the grass, propped on one elbow, and opens his book to her, the picture of her he keeps between the pages. Isabel tries to picture Elle. A woman in her 20s like Isabel, on the cusp of possible love, going about her life in this city, waiting for postcards. But she can't see her. She can only feel for her. Choir Girl. Isabel turns down Oak toward the little vintage shop at 4th Avenue, thinking of lunch. The Chinese place in Old Town, casting around inside herself for hunger, imagining the tastes of things. She steps up to the stoop of the vintage shop. It looks dark. No sign on the door to indicate whether it is open or closed, or what the business hours might be. Isabel knows this already from previous visits. She peeks through the window. A mannequin dressed in something Joan Crawford could have worn, elegant but angular, all shoulders, is headless, her fingers chipping away. Beyond the racks of dresses and blouses and coats, Isabel spies a dressmaker's dummy moving. Traffic thrums on the street behind her. She tries the door, unlocked, and a small string of bells jangles against the glass as she pulls it open and steps inside. "Hello," comes the muffled voice of the shopkeeper, and she pops up from behind the counter, bright white hair piled on top of her head. She lifts her hand in greeting, a pincushion attached at the wrist. "Hi," Isabel waves. "Oh, hello." She recognizes Isabel now. "It's Nancy Drew, isn't it?" "Good memory," Isabel says. The woman helped her assemble a girl sleuth costume last Halloween. "And how did it go?" "Perfect," she answers, her hands already running through the dresses on the rack to her right. "Of course it was," the woman answers, amused, turning back to her mending. Isabel remembers this amusement from the last visit as well. The woman seems ready to be pleased with the world. Isabel looks around and quietly inhales. She loves the smell of old things. Every available space bursts with clothing. Open hat boxes full of hankies, taffeta-lined suitcases offering slips and garters, circles within circles of shoes atop racks scrunched with skirts and blouses. For a moment, she is back in this morning's dream, amid the clothes, smelling the decay of cloth and leaves, feeling the weight of sleep in her limbs, and waiting for the birds to crow. She moves among the clothes, eyes drifting up to the dresses suspended from the ceiling, hovering far above her head, swaying as if dancing. She wonders what a group of dresses would be called if they were living things. A choir, she thinks, a choir of dresses. "So what brings you in today, hun?" She looks back at the shopkeeper, unsure how to answer. "A party dress," she says finally. "Aha," the shopkeeper says, pleased. "What kind of party dress?" "Blue," she says apologetically, shrugging. The shopkeeper laughs, a strand of white hair falling into her face. "Well," she says, "I've worked with less. How about this? What kind of party?" "It's for a playwright who just won some prestigious award. It's at his loft in Old Town, a renovated casket factory." "Ah, I know the place," the lady says. "Will there be dancing?" "Probably." "Definitely, I would say." She sticks a needle in the pincushion and pulls it from her wrist. She walks over to Isabel and stands back to take a look at her. "You're about what, 29-inch waist?" Isabel nods. "I may have something in the back from an estate sale last month. I'll have to dig for a minute. Meanwhile, you look around. You might find some things you like over here." Isabel turns to the rack nearest her. The dresses are from the 1930s, some of them so delicate she can't imagine anyone but ghosts wearing them. Faded flowers, velvet trim worn down to the ribbon, buttons nodding at the floor. She hears the shopkeeper tossing things around in her storeroom. Something falls and the lady curses, but it's a stifled, antiquated curse Isabel can barely make out. Something like bollocks. "Found it," the lady calls. "Oh yes, this is the dress for you, my dear." She emerges triumphant, dress folded over her arm. When she reaches Isabel, she holds the dress up by the shoulders, creamy cotton with a print of teal and sapphire umbrellas with black handles, sleeveless, a full dancing skirt. Isabel's heart leaps. "60s?" she asks. "I think so. Let's see." The lady peeks in the back by the zipper. "No label. If it had a label, I could tell you where she bought it and when. Probably Meyer and Frank. It's a classy, well-made dress. Early 60s, I would say, owing to that full skirt. But it's above the knee, and the pattern and cut around the shoulders say 60s for sure. Try it on." She hands it to Isabel and gives her a nudge toward the dressing nook. "You bought it from an estate sale?" Isabel asks, pulling the bark cloth curtain across the metal bar. There's a string of Chinese lantern lights around the mirror, and a little milk glass lamp with a fringed shade on a table. She lays the dress on an ottoman in the corner. "I bought the whole closet from the sister and brother-in-law of this woman," the shopkeeper tells her. "Nice old house in North Portland." She talks as Isabel undresses. Isabel hears the woman moving around, hanging clothes, her voice floating first near, then farther away, then back, the rattle of all the dresses on a rack shifting to make room for another. "Most of the clothes weren't very exciting," she continues. "But there were a couple of dresses like this one, and a really nice coat and some garment bags at the back. They obviously meant something to her. You don't keep a dress so long unless it means something to you." She probably met her first lover in that dress. Isabel hears a muffled laugh as she pulls the dress over her head. The cool fabric settles over her skin, and she thinks how this might be the first time in decades that a warm body has filled this space. She reaches behind her for the zipper and feels the fabric tighten around her as she draws it up to her mid-back, then stretch perfectly across her shoulders as she tugs it the last few inches up her spine. It's never the wedding dresses, you know. We keep those too, but only because they're so blooming expensive. No, I've seen enough old ladies' closets to know what we really hold on to. Not the till death do us part dresses. It's those first lovely dresses, the slow dance dresses, the goodnight kiss dresses. It's those first pangs we hold on to. Isabel turns to the mirror, bare feet pivoting on the geometric linoleum. In her reflection, she can almost see the girl who wore the dress before her. Architecture. Isabel had never smelled incense before she walked into her aunt's house. She was 9 and Agnes was 13. Their mother had brought them from their home in Alaska to visit her older sister in Seattle. Their aunt taught astrology and couples communication at the free school. Her husband was a carpenter. Years later, a waft of Nag Champa would send her back there, a big old house on a hill near Green Lake. Isabel was weary and followed Agnes across the threshold into the house, watching the backs of her sister's aqua jelly sandals. The heady odor made her blink and look around. They were in a living room with a saggy sofa, batik tapestries, books crammed into built-in shelves around the fireplace, and in stacks on the floor by the TV. Worn oriental rugs overlapped on the beaten wood floors. The astrologer led them to the guest room, where they heaped their bags on a mattress and box spring on the floor. Pictures of the astrologer's guru, a smiling woman with short dark hair and a red bindi at her third eye, were in almost every room. Isabel nudged Aggie to ask about them, but Aggie gave her a warning look, as if it would be rude. A patchouli plant in the front window stretched across the top of the television, tendrils through the rabbit ears. Their aunt and uncle left their doors open for the breeze and kept the bamboo blinds down over the windows, dicing the sunlight. The astrologer served them tea and coffee on a dining table she said had belonged to their great-great-grandmother, Gigi, who had been a flapper and was married 4 times. Gigi and her sister had a little hair salon in their house in Mount Vernon, the astrologer said. During the week, ladies would come and get pin curls and have their finger waves set. Then on the weekends, Gigi and Nell would drive all evening to get to the speakeasies in Seattle. Isabel drank her chamomile from a delicate porcelain cup, and after each sip, carefully placed the cup back into its saucer, trying not to spill. On the table sat a jar of honey, with the comb suspended inside, sunlight suspended in the comb. She had never seen a house like this before, and she had never met people like the astrologer and the carpenter. The astrologer wore long skirts and hand-dyed scarves around her hair, which was dark and curly just like Isabel's mother's hair, but with more gray. She wore a rose quartz on a ribbon around her neck. The carpenter walked around barefoot in threadbare t-shirts and running shorts. He asked Isabel lots of questions about herself, questions no one had ever asked her, like whether she liked living in Alaska and whether she would ever want to live anywhere else. She told him her grandmother had just gone to London and Dublin and sent her postcards. She wanted to travel to these cities someday. He nodded seriously when she answered, saying, "Right on," and holding eye contact long after both of them had finished speaking, until Isabel felt awkward and looked away. They both treated Isabel and Agnes as if they were much older, as if it were okay to say "shit" in front of them, and to offer them sips of wine. They let Isabel play the piano in their dining room, though she didn't know how, and she felt obliged to make up songs on the spot. Then they enthusiastically praised her musical talent. At dinner, they ate a vegetarian stew with eggplant and artichoke hearts. Their mother made a point to explain to Isabel and Agnes that these were vegetables that they couldn't get at home in Soldotna. "Mmm," said Agnes, pretending to like it. "Oh," said Isabel, trying to sound impressed. "Is that the bathroom faucet?" the astrologer asked suddenly, setting down her glass of wine. They all listened intently. Isabel heard the faint trickle of water down a drain. "We have a ghost," the carpenter said. "He turns on the bathroom tap." Isabel and Agnes stared at them. "Why?" Agnes finally asked. "Why would it do that?" "He's just doing what he did when he was alive," the astrologer said. "Things he did over and over again, like walking the hallway to the bathroom and turning on the faucet." Isabel went pale and dropped her fork. "Belly's afraid of ghosts," Agnes reported, as if she were not. "Well, there's nothing to be afraid of," her aunt said, giving Isabel a sympathetic look. "Ghosts are just energy, like an echo of someone's life." "Someone dead," Agnes said to Isabel. Their mother elbowed Agnes to stop and forked a piece of eggplant from her younger daughter's plate. "Just think of it as an echo," their aunt said. "An echo can't hurt you, Isabel." Isabel was skeptical. She avoided going to the bathroom all through dinner and dessert until she couldn't contain all the tea in her bladder anymore. She trod quietly into the dark living room, then the hallway, and to the bathroom door, ajar. She took a deep breath as she placed her hand on the crystal knob, reached inside for the light, and filled the room with a comforting yellow glow. She shut the door and hurried to the toilet, then sat there, staring at the pink and black beehive tiles, begging her suppressed bladder to obey. Night had come, and the dark loomed outside the frosted glass window. She decided against washing her hands. The next day, the astrologer took them to Pike Place Market. They wandered through the sea of people, the shouts and reek of the fishmongers, the bright clutches of sweet peas and coffee cans. Then down the stairs into the belly of the market, a great hollow space like the inside of a ship, with varnished wood plank floors that creaked and groaned with the waves of tourists. There, on a long gallery of little shops, Isabel spied a sign that said, "Ephemera Maps and Photographs." "What's that word?" she asked, pointing to the sign. "What word?" her aunt looked up. "Ephemera?" Isabel nodded. "Ephemera means old paper things, old printed things. Do you want to see?" When they entered the shop, Isabel thought of her photographs and the shoebox at the Salvation Army thrift store. But this was a whole store full of old photographs, newspapers, magazines, postcards, even packets of letters. Isabel found a box of postcards and flipped through them, counting the cities she saw, Paris, Rome, Barcelona, Vienna, but couldn't decide which she wanted most. She moved from box to box, picking up postcards and turning them over to read the captions. Agnes and her mother moved on to another shop, but the astrologer stayed, striking up a conversation with the old man behind the counter. Isabel wanted to leave with something, but she wasn't sure what to choose. She had never seen such a selection of ephemera before. In the back of the shop, she found a box with postcards of Washington and Oregon. The Columbia Gorge, the Space Needle, trees and animals and coastline, the Canadian border. Then Isabel flipped to a scene she recognized. Three Tlingit totem poles against a backdrop of spruce trees. She turned the card over. Totem Bite, near Ketchikan, Alaska. She took the card to the counter, where the astrologer and the shopkeeper looked at her expectantly. "Did you find something?" her aunt asked. Isabel nodded and laid the postcard on the counter in front of the shopkeeper. "How much is this postcard?" she asked. "Let me see," he said, and picked it up carefully, turning it over and regarding it seriously from all sides. "This one is $1," he said. "Would you like it?" her aunt asked. Isabel pulled her beaded change purse from her pocket and counted out $1 in quarters and dimes. The man slipped the single postcard into a thin paper bag and handed it back to her. When Agnes saw Isabel's postcard, she laughed at her sister and called her silly. "When you go on vacation, you buy postcards of the place you're visiting, not the place you're from," Agnes told her. Isabel was embarrassed, but stubborn enough not to show it. "I picked this one on purpose," she said. "It reminds me of home." "Me too," the astrologer said, putting her arm around Isabel. "I love things that remind me of where I came from." That night after dinner, while the carpenter worked in the garage, the astrologer brought Agnes, Isabel, and their mother to her bedroom. They all sat on the bed while the astrologer went into her closet for something. She emerged with a small wooden box. It had been decoupaged with colorful images of flowers from old greeting cards, violets and pansies and forget-me-nots. "This was Grandma Gigi's," she said, resting it on the bed. She took a framed picture from her dresser and handed it to Agnes. Isabel leaned in to look. It was a matte print from the 1930s of a woman about their mother's age. The family resemblance wasn't obvious, but the shape of the eyes and the nose looked like their mother and their aunt, and somewhat like Agnes. The astrologer went to her closet again and pulled out a dress, the dress Gigi wore in the photograph, brown silk with ivory beadwork along the collar, long sleeves cinched at the wrists, pleated skirt. It looked so small, too small for either her mother or aunt to wear, but small enough that Agnes might. They spent the evening looking through old photographs and reading letters. Before they went to bed, their aunt opened up the little decoupaged box and revealed a few pieces of jewelry nestled carefully on a silk scarf. She let the girls gaze into the box, then told them to pick one thing each for themselves. The girls looked at their mom, then at each other. There were glittery costume brooches, a mother-of-pearl bracelet, and a gold watch. But Agnes chose an amber pendant that the astrologer said had been a gift from Gigi's third husband, Vern. Isabel chose the smallest thing in the box, a garnet ring. It was too large for her, but she put it on her middle finger and spun it round and round. That night, as the sisters lay side by side on their mattress, they talked in hushed voices about what it must have been like to live back then, and how lovely the clothes were, and how exciting to have an adventuress in the family. They said that someday they would have daughters, and they would save precious things for them, too. On the last day of their visit, they went for a walk in the astrologer's neighborhood. They all enjoyed looking at the older houses with their roses and wisteria and other flowers that you didn't see in the yards in Alaska. The carpenter pointed out different architectural features of the houses and how differently houses were designed today. "Most of the houses in this neighborhood are called foursquare," he said, "because of the rooms in each of the four corners of the house. They call them Seattle boxes when the porch is under the second-story overhang like this." He pointed to a house in the middle of the block. "You could order a house from Sears Roebuck and Company in those days. It came with everything you needed to build the house, from plans to shingles and floorboards to doorknobs. You could build it yourself, or with your neighbors, or hire someone like me to do it for you." They were back at her aunt's house, looking at the cracked cement stairs that curved up to the porch, the roses clambering over the picket fence, the lawn gone to seed and white clover. "You can always tell when something is handmade," the astrologer said, sighing. "They just don't make things like they used to."
You've been listening to Alexis M. Smith reading from her novel, Glaciers. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Join us next time for the next installment of Isabel's story. If you've missed an episode of this book or want to listen again, you can find past episodes at SpokanePublicRadio.org or by subscribing to The Bookshelf podcast. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. This episode was recorded, edited, and produced by me, Chris Messini. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Windham.